The flowers ranged from full-blown blooms with petals dripping from their heads to tiny, unopened buds. And there were thorns. Well, hey folks, how are you? This is Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster for the Mystery Hour. Thank you for tuning in and joining us here on Sunsounds of Arizona. Absolutely outstanding to have you with me. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and Jocelyn Chase bring us our first story. It's called Delivering the Egg MacGuffin. Willa Pierce bit her lip and followed the butler up a wide, gracefully curving staircase. Last time she'd traversed this course, she'd let her gaze wander to the rich carpets, the extravagant paintings, and exquisite sculptures. A gorgeous Chinese screen in crimson silk stood out in her memory as a thing of inestimable value. She'd entertained the delicious idea that someday she might live surrounded by such beauty. This time, she had no such hope. The butler's leather-soled shoes made a little noise on the marble steps, and Willa felt each loudly echoing tap of her own high-heeled pumps like a nail in her coffin. A lump rose in her throat, and she got another taste of the burnt toast she'd forced down at breakfast. Swallowing hard, she kept her eyes focused on the taut shape of the well-formed muscles beneath the servant's custom-tailored suit as he climbed the stairs. Willa wondered, as she had before, if the rugged-featured, handsome butler was more to Alberta Blair than a mere manservant. She'd sensed something intimate between them, though Blair was a good 15 years the senior of the pair and a hard-bitten battle-axe of a woman. Some men might find that attractive. They gained the top of the staircase, and Willa was relieved to find her heels muffled in a deep pile carpet, sinking an inch into it with each step. The butler threw open a door at the end of the hall, and Willa entered, assailed by the scent of roses. Vases, urns, and bowls of roses rested on every shelf and table, all blood-red or pristine white. No pink or yellow blossoms here. The flowers ranged from full-blown blooms with petals dripping from their heads to tiny, unopened buds. And, well, there were thorns. Willa shuddered. Last time in this room, she'd been filled with confidence, sure she was on the road to a stellar career. The smell of roses had seemed fresh, intoxicating, inspired. No, their presence was cloying and made Willa think of a casket being lowered into a grave. Maybe her own? The butler stopped in front of an enormous mahogany desk and stepped to the side, bringing Willa face to face with Alberta Blair, broker extraordinaire in the world of thieves. "Well?" the woman demanded, her tone clipped and unyielding. "Report!" Willa stared into the black marble eyes and gulped.
I don't know how to tell.
"I want a clear and complete rundown of everything that happened, Pierce. Can you do that?" Willa gripped her hands together, squeezing hard.
"Yes."
"Then get on with it." Willa breathed deep and lifted her chin. "To pull this off, I've been playing three separate roles over the last 5 weeks. First, I got a job as a maid in the Teeterman residence."
"The house where the private collection is kept?"
"Yes." "When you tasked me with getting the Dalmatian egg, I did some digging and found out that Jan Teeterman purchased the Fabergé egg last year at Claridge's. He housed it among his private collection on his Mercer Island estate."
"Good. What else?"
"I started volunteering at a local soup kitchen working the Saturday morning shift." The forehead beneath Blair's bleached and rough-chopped hair furrowed.
"Okay, pin a medal on you, Pierce. But how does this help me?"
"I noticed that the Teeterman cook prepares a box of food every Friday evening for the housekeeper to deliver to the local soup kitchen on Saturday morning." Blair nodded.
"Continue." I shared a load of juicy gossip with the maid responsible for cleaning the library, where the collection is kept. Yolanda was only too happy to reciprocate while I helped her clean. She didn't notice me watching while she punched in the code to deactivate the security system so she could dust the display cases. Willa paused. I tested it. It worked. Then, all I had to do was wait until the big Friday night party. She'd been put on silver platter detail, circulating among the guests with trays of hors d'oeuvres. Laughter and conversation rose and fell like the murmuring of the sea, while piano music tickled in the background, played by a man with an eye patch with long, flowing hair. Ladies wore silk gowns in black or shimmering jewel tones, ruby, emerald, sapphire blue, while the gentlemen sported classic black-on-white tuxedos. Willa and the other maids had worked extra hours the previous day to bring the woodwork and marble up to a brilliant shine, and the faint odor of pine oil still hung in the air. Willa's plan required a distraction, so she'd prepared a special hors d'oeuvre for a random unfortunate guest. The cream cheese and caviar concoction, laced with finely chopped ghost peppers, rested at the center of her tray. When the Asian man who popped it into his mouth began to cough and writhe on the floor, Willa put down her tray and fled. With everyone's attention on the choking guest, she was able to mount the stairs without notice and enter the corridor outside the library, where the Dalmatian egg waited for her on a gold-plated pedestal. Chad, the security guard tasked with patrolling the upper floors during the party, was heading away from her, thumping softly along the carpeted floorboards. Willa knew he'd use the service staircase at the end of the hall to access the third floor before returning for another circuit past the library. She waited until she heard the clunk of his shoes on bare hardwood, then let herself into the library and entered the 5-digit code she'd seen Yolanda use. Holding her breath, Willa waited for the beep. The backlit keypad blinked from red to green. Go time. Heart pounding like it always did when she was about to seize the prize, Willa removed the glass-cutting tool from her bra and used it to score a circle in the display case right beside the gleaming jeweled egg. She punched the circle into the case, and the egg was hers. Her maid's uniform had no pockets. Even the white apron was more for looks than utility and provided no place for her to hide the egg. It was back to the old sports bra. She nestled the egg between her breasts and hoped, as she'd come to expect, that no one would spare a second glance for the hired help. Willa hurried to the door, but as she reached it, something thudded against it from the outside, and the doorknob twisted. The door started to open inward. Gasping, Willa pushed all her weight against the slab of wood, gritting her teeth and pushing hard. She felt it latch and turned the bolt, stepping back to catch her breath. Pressing her ear against the cool, polished wood, she listened. The door bucked slightly in its frame, and she heard soft grunts and moans. She imagined a couple groping, making out, their impatient passion blocking her exit. As the doorknob twisted and rattled, Willa moved to Plan B. Behind the sofa, she found a decorative grill covering a ventilation duct about 2 feet square, large enough for her to squeeze into. She came out in the adjacent room, someone's bedchamber, and eased the door open an inch to peer out. The couple had vanished, and the hallway was empty. Smoothing her hair into place, she took a deep breath and plunged into the corridor. She didn't dare use the service stairs for fear of running into Chad as he descended for another turn past the library. Where was Chad? Had he already come past and dispersed the overeager lovers, or had they simply found a better venue? Willa hurried down the staircase and past the ebony black grand piano, followed by a whirl of Chopin. Oh, she nearly made it to the kitchen when she was stopped by a man weaving in front of her, spilling champagne from his wobbling flute.
"Excuse me, miss,"
he hiccuped and covered it with a giggle.
"Could you tell me?"
He trailed off, staring at her oddly augmented chest. He raised his glass.
"I'll drink to that,"
he said, tipping champagne down his chin.
Three's company, two's a crowd.
Willa ground her teeth, impatient to get past the drunken guest to the safety of the kitchen.
The restroom is just through there, sir, she told him, pointing toward the powder room. Stepping around him, she pushed through the heavy swing doors into the kitchen and sighed with relief.
As anticipated, the cook was much too busy preparing canapes and chopping garnishes to notice her as she rushed past and let herself into the pantry, closing the door behind her. Trembling from the adrenaline flooding through her veins, Willa took a moment to steady her breathing and slow her racing heart. Then she stepped to a double row of Maxwell House coffee cans lined up on the pantry shelf. Going up on her tiptoes, she reached for the last can resting against the wall and removed the plastic lid. She'd purchased this specially constructed can years ago and found it useful many times. It was well designed with a fake seal, which could be removed to reveal a secret compartment. Digging the fabulous jeweled Fabergé egg from her bra, Willa inserted it into the compartment and tamped the seal over it. She shook the can and heard ground coffee move inside, a night's touch of verisimilitude. As she pressed the plastic lid back into place, she heard someone come into the kitchen and speak to the cook.
"Where's that pretty maid?" asked the familiar, slurred voice.
Willa groaned. She moved to the louvered door and peered through the slats. It was the drunk. She stared at him, consternated. Too bad he was a lush and a boor. He was actually quite good-looking.
"The serving wench,"
he persisted with the cook, leaning over the counter with a leer.
"She came in here."
"There's no one here but me," the cook assured him. "Can I pour you a cup of hot coffee, sir?"
"You're hiring her."
He lurched toward the pantry door, but before he'd gone two steps, a piercing alarm blared through the house in agonizing bleeps.
"My stars, what's happened?"
The cook wiped her hands on her apron and rushed from the kitchen, the drunk staggering after her. Willa leapt from the pantry and substituted her loaded coffee can for the one in the box slated for the soup kitchen. She placed the real coffee on the pantry shelf and hurried out into the massive foyer where guests had assembled in bewildered groups, hands over their ears. The alarm shut off. Jan Tiedemann stepped into the center of the room.
"I apologize, ladies and gentlemen, for the ear-shattering end to what I hope was a lovely evening."
A few guests clapped. Others raised a glass and shouted, "Hear, hear!"
"I'm afraid I'll have to detain you all a bit longer," he continued.
"Someone has stolen the Fabergé egg from my private collection." Gasps and shocked expressions rippled through the crowd. Willa let her mouth drop open and eyes go wide in case anyone was watching.
"The police will be here momentarily, and they will have questions. Once they release you, my private security staff will search each of you as you leave, with your permission, of course."
He smiled, confident that none of his guests would deny him that liberty. No one did. Willa finished her recital of the night's events, letting her clenched hands fall to her sides as she stared at Alberta Blair, master black market broker, and the woman who hired her to steal the Dalmatian egg.
"That's how it happened," she said. "And you were at the soup kitchen bright and early in the morning to make the coffee?"
"I was." Blair said nothing, only stared at Willa with narrowed eyes.
When I opened the can, there was only coffee inside."
"Imagine that," Blair said, motioning imperiously to the butler. He left the room. Willa wondered if he'd gone to fetch the executioner.
"You mentioned three roles you played," Blair continued. "The maid, the coffee maker. What's the third?"
Willa looked down at her hands. "This is it. Thief reporting in." Blair grunted. The butler ushered in a new visitor, dressed in a suit with loosened tie. Blonde curls cascaded over his forehead, heavy-lidded blue eyes scrunched half-closed against the light. He moved gingerly to stand beside Willa, giving her a close-up view of the reddened lump
swelling one side of his head. She knew him. The drunk.
The blond man cringed, raising his arm to ward off the flood of light through the window at Blair's back. The master broker tipped her head to the butler.
Richard, if you please.
The manservant moved to the window and lowered the blinds, tempering the light to a softer glow. The drunk croaked his thanks and rubbed his face, letting out a long, musical moan. A sprinkling of light freckles covered the backs of his hands and spread among the fair hairs of his forearms. He wore no rings. He finished his ministrations and turned his eyes on Willa. They closed, then popped open again.
That's her! You got her!
He pumped a fist and fixed a venomous look on Willa. She returned at full force.
She's the one who nearly destroyed my operation.
Willa's jaw dropped.
Your operation?
Blair cleared her throat. Pierce, meet Kurt Sullivan, the man I hired to steal the Dalmatian egg.
Willa's stomach shimmied under the assault of confusion, fury, and unease. She glowered at Blair, but the woman only gestured toward a chair.
Sit, Pierce. It's likely to be a long explanation, and this time you're not the one standing on the dock.
Willa stumbled to a chair and sank into it, struggling to sort through her feelings of hurt pride, disappointment, and simple longing. For years, she'd learned from some of the best thieves in the business, honing and practicing her skills, waiting for a chance to prove her worth. Now, she'd blown that chance to bits.
Blair scowled across her massive desk at the man swaying before her.
I want to know what happened, Sully. Beginning to end.
Right, he said, spreading his legs and standing at attention like a sailor aboard a ship at sea. It wasn't easy, but after a lot of digging, I pinpointed the location of the egg. It was part of a private collection owned by Jan Tiederman, kept at his house on Mercer Island.
Willis smirked, finding that information had taken her all of 2 minutes and 6 mouse clicks.
Tiederman threw a big bash at his place last night, but by admission, it was by printed invitation only. Guests arrived and parked along the dark tree-lined lane. All I had to do was put on my tuxedo and wait until I saw a man alone. I knocked him unconscious, zip-tied him and gagged him, and locked him in the trunk of his own car.
Blair raised an eyebrow.
It was a warm night, Sullivan said. Plenty of air in the trunk. He missed the party, but he got a good nap out of it, and he never saw me coming. I used his invitation to gain access and scope out the place. I soon realized the collection must be upstairs, and I'd need a way to get up there without arousing suspicion.
Just as the thought occurred, an Asian gentleman beside me started coughing and gagging. He dropped to the floor and curled up like a baby. I was about to call out for a doctor in the house when I realized I could be that doctor.
Willa sat stunned in her chair. He'd been right there, that close to her, while she served up the pepper-laced hors d'oeuvre. She hadn't stuck around to see the rest of the drama.
Well, I knelt down beside the guy. His face was red and he was gasping for breath, but I thought he was overdoing it a little. Well, maybe going for the attention.
The lady of the house arrived and I asked if there was somewhere private where I could attend to the guest.
I helped the man to his feet and we followed her upstairs to a spare bedroom. I got the man a glass of water and told him to rest. Then I cracked the door and saw a security guard walk past, patrolling the place. I figured I could overpower him, take his uniform, and escape with the egg, and no one the wiser until I'm far away.
So that's what happened to Chad. Willa spared a moment of sympathy for the security man, who always had been nice to her.
I took the guard from behind, Sullivan continued, and tried to choke him out, but he was a fighter. We struggled, and for a while I wasn't sure who would come out on top. I had him by the neck, but he pushed me up against the door, and I thought it would open and dump us on the floor and to tussle, not like wrestlers, but the door held tight, and finally the guy went limp.
Willa pressed her lips together, hiding a smile, remembering the gasps and groans she'd mistaken for lovers' passions.
By now, she was listening with rapt interest to Sullivan's account.
Okay, I needed a secure place to dump the unconscious guy, so I used a credit card to jimmy the lock and saw I had a good news, bad news situation. The good news? Well, I'd found the private collection.
The bad news?
The Dalmatian egg was gone.
Blair turned her eyes on Willa, approval in her expression, and Willa felt a small thrill of pleasure.
But I wasn't ready to give up, Sullivan said. I thought the egg might still be somewhere on the premises, and I was right.
Sullivan twisted his stance and narrowed his eyes in an accusing glaze at Willa. She lifted her chin and said nothing.
I dragged the guard behind the sofa, and that's when I saw the grill cover leaning against the wall and freshly disturbed dust in the ventilation duct. I rushed downstairs to inspect all the well-dressed guests for dust. She, he said, pointing at Willa, was scurrying off to the kitchen like a scared rabbit when I spotted her grimy uniform. Disgraceful.
You were disgraceful, Willa shot back.
Yes, I was, Sullivan agreed. I snatched a glass of champagne off a passing tray and accosted you as a drunk man.
Very convincing, too.
I found you even more attractive when I noticed that you had three breasts.
Willa's face went hot. She pulled in a deep breath, aching to hit him with a zinger, but drew a blank. She shut her mouth.
Our well-endowed maid, he explained to Blair, pointed me to the men's room, and I found I really did need to pay a visit. When I got to the kitchen, only the cook was there, but I suspected our girl was hiding in the pantry. Before I got a chance to check, that hellish alarm went off, and everyone ran into the foyer to see what all the fuss was about.
You went too, Willa said. I saw you.
I did. Then I turned around and watched through the little window in the kitchen. I saw you swap the coffee cans, and that told me where to find the egg. Once you left, I swapped the coffee cans back again.
You vile rat! I worked hard on that plan.
Well, not hard enough. Sullivan's smile almost looked apologetic, which enraged Willa all the more. Now my problem was getting the egg out of the house. The police were on site, and Teeterman's security team was searching everyone and everything. All was utter chaos, and no one paid me much mind when I went back upstairs and rummaged through the bathroom for inspiration.
You do that a lot? Willa asked.
What, search for inspiration?
No, paw through people's bathrooms.
Well, of course, what self-respecting thief doesn't?
At the back of a cabinet, I found an old medicine case filled with diabetic supplies, just the right size for the egg. I dusted it off and put it in my pocket, then tried to leave the house. The guards frisked me and asked to see what was in the bag. I hedged like I didn't want them looking inside. Of course they insisted, and I watched mortified while they violated my privacy. They nodded me through, but I hadn't taken three steps before I patted my pockets and realized I'd left my phone in the house.
The approval in Blair's eyes was now for Sullivan.
Willa felt a pinprick of jealousy and brushed it aside. The guards let me go back to retrieve the phone, but I saw one of them roll his eyes. I hurried to the pantry, extracted the egg from the coffee can, and zipped it into the case. By now, Teeterman's security team was pretty annoyed with the tipsy, forgetful diabetic. They passed me through with a curious pat-down, glad to be rid of me. On the way to my car, I popped the trunk for the man whose invitation I borrowed, as a token of my appreciation. I drove home, making sure I wasn't followed, but I was just being overly cautious. No one was on to me.
Sullivan spoke in a wry, self-deprecating tone, and Willa ground her teeth, determined not to like the man, but failing just a little.
I got out of the car, he continued, stooped down to pet the cat, and wham! Lights out, egg vanished.
And now, feeling a little bit more. Thanks to him, Willa was not alone in botching the job.
And the man liked cats?
So that explains your sore head, she said. I thought it was a hangover.
I never had a hangover. And now, a little less. A deep, sonorous tone rang out, and Richard, the butler, left to answer the door. In his absence, no one spoke, and Willa began to fear the reprieve she'd sensed was based on false hope. No one failed Alberta Blair without paying a steep price. Willa heard footsteps approaching along the corridor and held her breath. Who's coming? Hangman? Firing squad? Richard opened the door to admit the third visitor of the day. A gentleman holding a glistening jeweled egg. Willa stared at the fabulous Fabergé egg, and then at the man who held it at chest level, his hands curled around it like a protective nest. The last time she'd seen him, he'd been choking on ghost peppers. Blair beamed at the man. Willa, Sully, meet Hyung Jin, the other man I hired to steal the Dalmatian egg. Willa blinked. The anger, hurt, and disappointment roiling in her breast burned off like fog against the rising sun, giving way to curiosity and a stirring of stubborn hope. Have a seat, Sully, Blair said, gesturing to the chair beside Willa. You're going to enjoy this. Jin is a hacker of the First Order. Hyung Jin took a modest bow and placed the egg with reverence on the polished mahogany desk. I discovered the egg's location, he said, in 2.3 seconds. It took only 16 seconds more to find out about the party and hack the guest list, making sure I received a printed invitation. He ran a hand over his hair, smoothing down a slight cowlick in a nervous motion that suggested he was not as calm as he appeared, Willa sympathized. Once inside the house, he continued, I was within range to send a signal to library security system. I designed a program to encrypt the code and deactivate the system, but it would take time. I estimated 15 to 20 minutes. Meanwhile, I needed to figure out a way to get upstairs without arousing suspicion. Willa bit down, trying to stop the smile spreading over her lips. A server came by, Jin acknowledged her with a nod, carrying a tray of fancy bite-sized snacks, and I took one. Eating helps me think. To my delight, the canapé I chose contained ghost pepper, one of my favorites, but so rare at such a party. Oh, I savored the snack, but then I realized I could use it to my advantage. I began coughing. I fell to the floor and rolled around, clawing at my throat. I had to make it look good, but not too good. I wanted to end up in the private rooms upstairs, not in the back of an ambulance. Blair's interested gaze held approval, and Willa was surprised to find she didn't begrudge it much. That guy, Jin gestured to Sully, knelt beside me and told me he was a doctor. He removed my bow tie and took my pulse, and that's when I knew he was lying. No one in medical profession measures a pulse with their thumb. He tossed a withering glance Sully's way. I figured he was probably after the same thing I was. Mrs. Tiedemann showed up and leaned us over in her low-cut evening gown, giving me ample opportunity to slide a GPS tracking dot beneath the Faith Doctor's wristwatch. Jin jutted his chin at Sully. At that point, I could have marched an elephant past unnoticed, so it was piece of cake. Doc there asked for a private room, and I was half surprised when he took me along. Cut the snark, Sully snapped. My mind was entirely on the operation. Oh, of course, forgive me. Jin's face broke into an impish grin as he turned back to Blair. In upstairs room, the doctor gave me a glass of water. He made sure I was comfortable and told me to rest. I pretended to fall asleep. Willa leaned forward, wondering how the rest of this story would touch on her own. Doc left room, and I watched through crack in door as he wrestled with security guard and jimmied open the door to library. He dragged the unconscious girl inside, and I waited for him to come out with the egg. A few minutes later, he burst out of the room and ran downstairs empty-handed. I entered the library and saw the alarm system had been deactivated, and egg was gone. Everyone turned to look at her, and Willa felt a keen, if momentary, sense of fulfillment. She smiled.
"I realized my program was still working to decrypt code," Jin continued. "When it succeeded, it would toggle the system back on, setting off the alarm. I took out my phone to cancel the decryption, but I was too late. The alarm went off."
"The alarm is still going off," Sully said, cradling his brow and wincing. "Inside my head."
Jin's face was now somber. "Chaos ensued. I knew the place would soon be overrun with police and security. I had gadgets on my person that I neither wished to relinquish or explain. I got out before the search could be organized. I drove a short distance away and waited for the tracker to move. When it did, I followed."
Sully gave a low, disgusted growl. "I save you from choking to death, and you reward me with a club upside the head? How kind!"
Jin shrugged. "Oh, I just did what the job require."
Sully half rose from his chair, but Blair cleared her throat and gave him a stern look.
"As you must have surmised by now, I hired the three of you as a test, placing you in unwitting competition."
Willa's stomach twisted. Working to keep the tremble out of her voice, she said,
I suppose Jin made the cut then, and we're out on our ear."
"No, not exactly. None of you have succeeded in obtaining the Dalmatian egg."
Blair nodded once again to the butler, and he opened the door, summoning someone from the corridor. Willa waited to see who would appear in the doorway, and was mildly startled when Jan Teeterman stepped into view. He walked to the egg on Blair's desk and lifted it in his hands.
Thank you for this," he said.
The egg glittered in the light through the blinds, sending off sparks of brilliant color. Dropping it to the floor, Teeterman crushed the egg under his heel, turning it into a pile of shards and powder.
"Blair sold the real Dalmatian for me months ago on the black market. I did pretty well on that deal."
He smiled at the broker behind the desk.
"Oh, we both did," she said.
"Last night's performance was for the insurance company's benefit. There will be an investigation, but I have a man on the inside, and in the end, none of the clues left behind will pan out. They will pay me, and I will pay Blair."
"And I will pay you three," Blair added.
A small bubble of disappointment grew inside Willa's chest. Payment is good, but she'd hoped for a more long-term arrangement.
"So, that's it?" she asked. "It wasn't a real job, and now we're done?"
"Oh, it was definitely a real job," Blair assured her. "Just not the one you thought."
Blair rose from behind her desk. With measured steps, she walked to where Willa, Sully, and Jin sat in chairs like schoolchildren about to be addressed by the principal. She pivoted smoothly and faced them, fastening her hard black eyes on each of them in turn.
"I trust the three of you have learned from your mistakes," she said, "and from each other."
She drew a deep breath, nostrils flaring like a horse preparing to buck its rider.
"I expect you to get busy and work hard. By next week, I want you operating like a well-oiled machine, together, as a team. Our real target is the Tsarevich Egg, which arrives in town next Friday as part of a traveling exhibition."
She paused, surprising Willow with a softened expression, a slight twinkle in her eye.
"And this time," the boss ordered, "I expect you to bring me the real McCoy."
Okay, I'm going to stay in that same Alfred Hitchcock magazine. Iretta Y. Patterson is our next author, and the story is called Safe at Home. I still thought of the neighborhood I grew up in as safe. I mean, of course, doing my first cursory review before heading back home gave me a clue of what to expect. The housing app I downloaded outlined the ranking of Ruby Gate Elementary School, the school I spent 7 years walking to and from. Back then, the county was testing a new concept, placing elementary schools in neighborhoods. So, there I was, pigtailed with glasses in Wonder Woman brown to match the book bag slung across my body, the bag bumping against my thigh as I rushed to make it in time before the opening bell. When I was late, I'd cut through Ms. Robinson's backyard that backed up to the basketball court. That yard was a neighborhood favorite because the plum tree out front. My best friend, Cece, and I picked the plums when they were ripe, and Ms. Robinson never chased us away. She must have been too busy focusing on keeping the video arcade in business that was a front for money laundering to worry about us. The place I spent grades 1 through 7, middle schools hadn't been put in place yet, was now just a white number etched in blue with a proprietary score on a phone screen. Maybe it was accurate. That school had been shut down an entire year to remove asbestos. Now, though, it was up and running, flat with open walkways that mirrored the homes in the neighborhood. Ruby Gate Subdivision was built in the 1970s, and there were either flat ranch homes or split levels. East of Atlanta, outside the perimeter that surrounded the city, the parents chose the neighborhood because of the school district. Many had read an article about it being one of the top in the country when they decided to move to Atlanta to be closer to family after a short stint up north. We moved in. Then the neighborhood began to change, as evidenced by the class pictures my mom preserved in our family picture album. The number of black kids increased each year. The kids I grew up with in that neighborhood went on to gain letters behind their names, PhDs, MBAs, and various others. They graduated undergrad from places like Spelman, Morehouse, and Xavier rather than Emory, Georgia Tech, or University of Georgia. Their graduate degrees came from prestigious schools. It was a combination that worked well. Well, it worked for me. Later, the neighborhood began to decline, but it was so incremental, we really didn't notice it go from respectable suburban to hoodie bougie. It was the type of place where folks in the neighborhood golfed at the local golf course, but made sure there was a Glock in the bag. There was a drug bust across the street from the community center attached to the pool. I know, because I was there having a student council overnight retreat the night it happened. The whomping of police helicopters interrupted our midnight munching on potted meat sandwiches and cheese puffs. And though the sound of gunshots popping off at night were a normal occurrence, I never felt unsafe. It was home. I didn't see the cracks in the grade pavement as I'd bike around the winding streets of the subdivision until the sun got low enough to threaten the street lights coming on and missing my curfew. I didn't notice as the local mall's major department stores left and it became a sea of kiosks resembling more of a flea market than a treasured outing. It wasn't important. Now, coming back as an adult trying to figure out my next move in life, I was looking at this place with adult eyes. My parents had kept the house as a rental after they'd retired and offered it as a place to stay after I quit my job as a food scientist. When I couldn't take one more day of figuring out how to manipulate a potato chip into becoming more addictive. While here, I could investigate the neighborhood, perhaps look into doing some renovations. Mom had been making some noises about selling. I plan to keep to myself, but I still must have had a bit of that southernness in me, so to get comfortable in the place where I hadn't been in years and to remember how I settled on my career in the first place,
I baked a cake. A pound cake with extracts of a mix of vanilla, orange, almond, and lemon. Plain, nothing on the top, like a glaze. I like things neat, to show off the flavor.
You don't need fancy if you do it right, is something that my mother said. So the batter went into a plain tube pan.
It was familiar, and though the grocery store around the corner had dim lights and yellowing floors, I was able to pick up the supplies I needed. The best way to see anything was by foot, and the first stop I figured was next door. I figured Cece would be over there and we could catch up. When we were kids, we'd actually yelled across the yards at each other from our bedrooms. We'd grown apart, though, in high school when she set her sights on becoming a majorette and fell into that crowd. Most of my excitement back then came from pouring into thrifted books with yellowed pages, their covers illustrated with planets against a faded starry sky. It hurt to be left behind, though. I admired how ruthlessly she pursued her goal once she decided on it. Since I'd be staying there temporarily, it might be good to look her up. Christmas was a good enough excuse for stopping by. I set the cake on a rack for it to cool, but I was tempted to put it on the windowsill, like those old recipes from the checkered red and white cookbook that they changed each year. And then I got tired of waiting, so I slipped it into my mom's old Tupperware cake carrier, clear dome plastic with the burnt yellow base that matched its handles because, well, I figured Cece would get a kick out of it, and made my best impression. Steam clouded the dome. I'd never been an apron kind of baker, but luckily the flour that dusted the red mock turtleneck I was wearing would be covered by the hoodie. The hoodie was a staple of mine, despite what some might say about the danger, because I had short hair, and even though I didn't get that cold in Atlanta in December, sometimes the weather came out of the north field and shocked you. I made a habit of always buying jackets or pullovers with hoods to protect my head, and that day the wind was whipping enough in the neighborhood to make you pay attention. I locked the door behind me, traveled down the five steps and crossed the plain patch of grass that separated our yards. Most of the homes in the neighborhood were either a split level or a ranch. The split level back then was a popular type of house when the subdivision was established. They were all set up the same way. Kitchen, bedrooms, and formal spaces on the top floor, den and garage at the bottom, along with another bedroom that could provide privacy. Cece's house next door was a split level, and because I did not have the eyes of childhood, I saw it clearly. Brown with maroon shutters that could use some paint. The flower garden that Cece's mom had taken such pride in was now just covered over with pine straw. There had always been color at this house. Not anymore. Good thing there was not an HOA, because there was no way that broken-down Cadillac on bricks in the front yard with a hood up would have been allowed. The faint sound of a laugh track slipped through the walls, so I knew someone was there. Good. I'd never seen any of their cars out in the driveway, so I couldn't tell if they were in or not. The yard was mowed, but not edged. The sidewalk was only on one side of the street, and we're glad to get them. Sidewalks were considered a premium feature, probably something that had to do with the car-centric Atlanta. Now more people wanted to move to a place with public transportation, but even though DeKalb County had MARTA, the demand for homes in this area hadn't begun yet. It was still outside the perimeter, not close to a train station or places for cultural events. Any place on a bus line would be a hot property soon. But for now, this place was not, which put it right in the sweet spot. Still, there would be nothing like Cece's perspective. I rang the doorbell and waited. It didn't take long, but what I saw was a surprise. It was the girl I'd known
filled out with a face full of makeup in the evening, like perfect. But her eyes were hollow.
I brought you a cake. Silly, but the only thing that came out of my mouth.
Rainy,
she said. It was an old name from childhood, like a well-loved stuffed animal whose arms was stitched together in red thread with awkward stitches. Familiar. Loved. A name reserved for family. Most folks called me Serini, or Dr. Miller these days. It was nice to hear it from her, though. I didn't correct her. I held out the cake. And now we would go through the song and dance. She would invite me in, maybe pour me some saturated red Kool-Aid from a pitcher that had a layer of sugar at the bottom. We'd swap stories at her kitchen table about our lives, spontaneous laughter drowning out the canned laughter from the television. But it didn't happen. She looked back, and then back at me again.
I'd invite you in, but it's late.
She took the carrier and shut the door in my face. I mentioned the episode the next time I talked with my mom on the phone. The parents had moved down to a retirement community in Florida that was known for its conservative views and high rate of disease of the intimate nature. I was scrolling through Mountain Dew cake recipes on my tablet about to decide on one to bake. It was by request. Cece had returned the cake carrier with a plate and a fresh loaf of homemade bread. This wasn't from a bread machine or a stand mixer. There's a difference. She made these by hand. It became a thing unintentionally. I baked a cake, and she returned the plate with a fresh-made bread. We'd take walks, and I would wave to Fred, who was on the couch, his fingers pressing on a console with a barren, alien landscape across the screen. The walks were a way of me checking out the neighborhood, getting acquainted even as our conversations were pierced at least once a walk, with an ambulance siren slicing through the air. As she slimmed down and left the makeup off, the bruises became more pronounced. Fred, however, seemed to be gaining weight.
What's up with Cece?
I asked the question more for confirmation as I scrolled through the search results of recipes. The first one had over 1,000 five-star reviews. That'll do. Folks made things way more complicated than they needed to be. Box cake and Mountain Dew. Done and done. This one was going to be way easier than the pistachio cake she requested a couple of weeks ago.
Hey, Bater,
I grunted in response. Words, came my mother's admonition. I honestly didn't understand the need for words when other sounds made the point, but I started speaking.
Yeah, I figured. How is she?
Well, we've got an exchange going on with homemade bread and cake.
It's good that you're seeing her regularly. It's good that someone is seeing her regularly.
None of my business. That is practically the family motto. Don't stick your nose into someone else's business unless they ask. And from my research into domestic violence, the best to do is to let that someone know that they had a place to go, to be there. My mom's phrasing of seeing her regularly was code for it's good that you're noticing what is happening, that someone is around. An abuser might be able to keep her from family, which I noticed had not been around, but to hide from the next-door neighbor was tougher. Besides, I wasn't a threat. I was only staying there as a way station, staying in the house until I figured out my next move. Soon there would be another tenant, a person not connected to the neighborhood or to Cece. The cakes were for Fred, a bribe possibly, but it worked. I, after all, knew how to make food addicting. It had been my job, and the walks were encouraged because Cece was almost back at her majorette weight. We'd signed up to walk the Peachtree Road Race that was being held on the 4th of July.
I snapped a picture of her every week with the bread and kept them in a separate album on my phone and backed up. I always made sure to keep pamphlets around for services. I don't know if she saw them as I strategically made myself scarce for an exact 5 minutes. They were always there when I came back. We'd sip tea, then she'd go back home. My cakes had gotten more decadent from that first plain pound cake. Buttercream frosting, soda, eggs, and the fattiest butter I could find. Then there was the day I was finally invited into the house by Fred. He looked horrible, and there was a smell that emanated from him. Not a poker face at all. I tried to cover my dismay with my words, "You enjoying the cakes?" "All right, tasty," he said, and he patted his belly. "Thanks for the games." I might be slow on the uptake, but knew enough when to play along with what was happening because I definitely was not buying that man games. I'd already had to put a line item in my budget for baking supplies. "You're welcome." I followed Cece into the kitchen. One slice of cake was left from the old batch, but it had a glaze to it, something I'd never do to a plain cake. She told me to get out the water from the refrigerator, but there was a pitcher of Kool-Aid right there, and I grabbed it instead. I poured the red liquid into the two plastic cups she'd set out. Juneteenth was coming up, and red drink was for good luck. I turned to her and held out a glass. "Let's live a little," I said. She smacked the cup out of my hand, the red liquid staining the floor. The mask slipped, and the room felt colder. And this was a harder woman standing before me before she composed herself, taking a towel and sopping up the mess. "Sorry about that." It was as if she was playing a role, saying words she had said times before. "What's going on?" he called. "Oh, I dropped the cup. Sorry about that. I don't have coordination very well. I could never play games like yours. I probably wouldn't even get past level one." The laughter came from the other room. I took the paper towels and cleaned up the mess. She took the cup and threw it in the garbage. That was a bit overkill. Her reaction? The Kool-Aid? The request for cakes? Cece had always been smart, quick. Her decision to transform herself in high school had been methodical and calculating and executed with precision when she'd lost the weight. That, however, was none of my business. She pulled out the water pitcher. "Let's have water instead." She poured the liquid into two cups. I waited until she finished the entire glass before I took my first sip. After, I heard a sound I hadn't heard in decades. Cece's full body laugh. Fred passed away a month later. Natural causes due to his excessive appetite and not controlling the diabetes that ran in his family. Turns out he hadn't been to the doctor in years. Soon, the house next door looked more like it had when I grew up, with straight edges along the yard and pink rose bushes in the front yard. So, maybe the neighborhood wasn't as safe as I remembered as a child, hula-hooping in the driveway while my dad cut the grass. The first twinkling of fireflies as the light waned. And, well, maybe, just maybe, that was fine. All right, folks, in the last couple of minutes in the Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine, The Story That Won department, the picture that's been described by our reader who wrote a little story about it, looks like brick sidewalk with pavers on the sides, a little curb,
and lying forlornly in the gutter is a ripped-up teddy bear. The name of the story is called The Rangoon Queen by Jim Spitzer. Scotland Yard, London. I'm afraid, Inspector, that we're never going to find the diamond. By now, the Rangoon Queen has been smuggled out of the country. NYPD, New York. Sarge, we've been finding teddy bears all over town with their backs slit open.
Yeah, I know. We even had a video of a man ripping one out of a little girl's hand, slitting it open and throwing it over the fence.
Did the camera get a good face shot?
All we could tell is that the guy had glasses and a mustache, probably a disguise.
Bear Factory, an outlet, London. A man with glasses and mustache approached the proprietor after other customers left.
Excuse me, do you remember me from last week?
The proprietor smiled.
Sure, you're the gent who bought a bear and brought it back the next day and asked me to ship it to New York.
The mustache man scowled.
The bear has arrived and it wasn't the same one. Why not?
The proprietor rubbed his chin.
When I was walking to our shipping department, I dropped it and it landed in an oil spot left by a machine. I grabbed another bear off the shelf and shipped it.
Where's the original?
Realizing it was an obsolete model with perhaps sentimental value, I took it to my dry cleaners. He said he could replace the back and stuffing it I supplied with materials. Next day the shop was closed. A sign on the door said he had retired to Tahiti.
All right, folks, that's going to do it. Thanks for joining me here on the Mystery Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler saying, join me again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.